Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
So in today's episode, we're going to talk about the five most common symptoms of perimenopause.
And when we talk about the five, there'll probably be more than that because there could be some debate on what would be the most common symptom.
Yeah, I mean, this is honestly, you know, we didn't do any surveys or anything like that. This is just based on our memory and the feedback we get, you know, why women are reaching out to, you know, to find some help. And the things that, you know, granted, we could, like you said, we could add a few more to the list. There could be the top seven or the top 10 symptoms, but these are the ones that come up most of the time.
Exactly, because when I first started in practice in 2004, I mainly dealt with menopausal women. And then there was a shift since then where women in their 40s, they're not menopausal and they're coming to me saying, well, I think it's my hormones. I don't feel well. And, you know, like I said, we'll go through the symptoms. There's something everybody, you know, my docs say I'm fine and I'm healthy, but I don't feel fine. I really think it's my hormones, but I'm not in menopause. So that's where I think perimenopause is really kind of an underserved population, a huge population that we'd like to bring some light to.
Yeah. You know, I noticed the same type of, shift in, first it was all just menopause. And what would you say the last 10 years?
Yeah. I'd say, what is it? 2023 right now. Probably. Yeah. The last 10 years really that I started getting a lot more women. So, you know, granted in 2004, there was a lot of women that had been on these conventional medications like Premarin and Prempro that their doctors took them off of and didn't have any alternatives. So that's kind of when I kind of shifted, you know, started, you know, in 2004, that was kind of what a lot I dealt with was menopause. But you're right, probably about, you know, 2012, 13, that started getting more of an influx of younger women saying, you know, what's going on? I'm just looking for some answers and some help.
Yeah. And even still, even after it's been a decade, I still think that women in their 40s, late 30s to early 50s, right? That's the perimenopausal window. I think it's still a completely underserved market, a demographic of women that, you know, they're sort of, you know, in this very busy, what we see, they're very busy, very stressed, have a lot on their plate. And all of a sudden, just like literally almost like overnight, their bodies just stop cooperating. And they're sort of desperate because they have a lot of things to get done. They got to take care of the family, take care of the kids. They are working full time. I mean, that's part of the problem, right? Because they're spreading themselves a little thin.
But that's interesting you say that because we've talked about this is a lot of women. So you think perimenopause, really, I would say more like, you know, 42 to 50. That's if you really wanted to really narrow that number. There are some women that go into perimenopause a little earlier in their late 30s, and some women that don't go into menopause till almost 55, but really that 42 to 50 window. And I'll talk to these women and actually they'll say back in their 20s when they had, you know, kids and worked full time and got a divorce and they actually worked more jobs. They actually had more stress then, but was able to balance it and felt more, felt better. Their energy is better. They say they felt better than when in their 40s, when their kids are older, a little bit more, they have their more independence and autonomy. They maybe, you know, these women have a little bit more financial comfort, so they're feeling more safe. But then they say, but I feel worse than I did when I had so much going on in my 20s and early 30s.
Yeah, they still have some stress, but you're right. Life is less chaotic. But yet they don't have the, and this is the point of why we deal with these kind of situations, but they don't have the hormones to deal with the stress they actually have. When you're 25, you can handle anything. You're sort of male or female. You're sort of invincible because you have the hormones to kind of weather the storm a little bit. And that's where a lot of these things come from because there's this inevitable decline or shift that happens very abruptly. And it's really different. Oh, you know, we're going to do another one, you know, another episode about the the average onset or the age of onset of menopause? You just said 42 to 50. So is that what you would say?
Well, you just said the onset of menopause. So menopause. No,
I said perimenopause.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Okay. Well, you're right. I would say if I didn't, I'm
that's sorry.
Right. Yeah. Well, I just didn't want to confuse anyone. I would say really that perimenopause is 42, right around 42. You know, most women when they hit 40, they're like, this is great. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, 42, 43, there's like a little shift there. And then typical age of menopause is 51 and a half. But so there's that window there of a lot of women that, you know, I've had women come in to see me and they're in their mid 40s and they're saying, I'm in menopause. Even my doctors say I'm in menopause, but I'm telling them, well, you're having a regular period. It might have changed a little bit from when you were in your 20s and 30s, but you're having a period. You're not in menopause. You're in perimenopause.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, a lot of people are, you know, patient or just the public or practitioner is sort of on the lookout or is at least understands menopause, right? That's, you know, a woman's in her 50s. She stopped menstruating. She's having hot flashes. That one you can kind of see coming from a mile away. But the, you know, this range that women are going through, even still, I mean, you know, that's why they end up coming our way or, you know, looking for answers other places is because the conventional treatments just don't really solve any of their problems. They don't need an antidepressant. They don't need an IUD. They don't need birth control. So why don't we, kind of dive into what those things would be being recommended for. What are the five most common symptoms?
Real quick, I just want to sort of differentiate with menopause and perimenopause. Some people say, well, aren't they kind of just the same thing? No, they're not. Actually, you know, with perimenopausal women, I do a completely different treatment plan than you would do with a menopausal woman. So they are two separate demographics.
Yeah. Now, granted, one obviously transitions to the next, you know, within a few years, obviously. But you're exactly right. The treatments you would use for a menopausal woman don't always apply to the perimenopausal woman. So how are you still going to, you know, find a solution to whatever symptoms they have without necessarily making more problems because you're using a menopausal prescription, which we'll sort of touch on a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say for perimenopause, there's actually a few biggest things. I don't know what to name first, but really, I would say the irritability. Women will say, I'm not sad and weepy. I'm not depressed. I'm mad. I'm annoyed. I'm irritated. My patience has gotten so short, and that's not me. And they'll say it's not even for anything like, sure, you can get angry at something that's warranted, but they'll say I get irritated at the littlest things that really are no big deal.
You get irritated at me all the time.
No, I don't.
All the time.
No, I don't.
You're irritated all the time.
I'm really not an irritated person.
But it's, some things like I'll ask, of course, patients will say the word irritable before I even ask them. It just comes out of their mouth almost fluidly. Oh, I'm just so irritable all the time. And I'm like, oh yeah. The way your husband breathes, the way he chews, the way he does little simple things, and it just drives them crazy. You know, so what things do I do that drive you crazy?
You are an angel.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I know you're lying. you're just making stuff up now, but that's okay. Yeah. You know, that's fine. But, just little things that normally, you know, even probably a year ago, 6 months ago, probably wouldn't have bothered them, but then all of a sudden it's like a flip of the light switch and they're just, you know, 1 minute they're fine. The next minute they want to strangle them.
Yeah. And nobody, I've had patients say, and granted, I do get irritable. I am 49. I'm going to be turning 50 this year, but they will, a lot of patients will say, it's almost like I don't even want to be in the same room with myself. I just don't, you know, nobody likes that feeling when, you know, your stomach's kind of tight and you're just annoyed, but it's really not that big a deal. And, go for a walk, go meditate, something. But it really is the hormones that are setting you up for that.
Yeah, at least they make it so it happens a lot more frequently. Okay, so irritable, you know, mood swing, the pendulum kind of goes back. And 1 minute they might be crying, then next minute they might be angry. What we've noticed is that mostly it's more on the anger, irritable side. You know, a little bit on the crying side, but, you know, sometimes the anger turns into tears or the tears turn into the anger. It kind of goes back and forth. What we try to do is keep that pendulum swing more in the middle. So there's less variance from one emotional end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum.
Well, as women, we tend to internalize anger. You know, we're men, you know, especially young men, they might externalize when they're angry. So for women, that I do think the tears come from like that, you know, I got mad at my husband. I was snappy. I was rude to my kids. I yelled at my kids. And then they feel bad. They say, you know, I feel really bad about my behavior. And then that can turn into tears. So like I was trying to say, they're not necessarily like depressed or melancholy or nostalgic or, you know, blue. It really is. They're just irritated.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, I think sometimes husbands kind of pick up on that a little bit and they use it to their advantage.
Do they?
You know, they're like, well, I don't do it to you,
never.
But I could. I'm trying to do it right now. You know, that your, you know, your hormones are, I think it's your hormones. I think you should see someone about that.
I've had lots of couples come in and the husbands are saying, I think it's our hormones.
I'll have a couple of husbands say, the patients will tell me, says, I think you need to go back to see Dr. Mackey. I think you need to tweak your hormones a little bit.
Which makes us even more irritated.
Yeah. Well, that's unfair, right? You know, because I'm a dumb man, right? So I'm sure the husbands are, you know, just big kids causing most of the problems, right? If they had a little bit more of a clue, they probably wouldn't be so irritated. So I think men bring it on sometimes. But like you said, when they're 25, they can handle it. They just, things rolls off the back a lot easier. And now as those hormones are changing, they just don't have the bandwidth anymore.
And then I would say the next one that a lot of women complain about is belly fat. Is really, it's almost like, you know, hey, I gained, you know, 10 pounds overnight, or I never used to have a belly and now I do. That's probably really high up there and a big, you know, a big symptom.
Oh yeah. Well, we've talked about that one too in a roundabout sort of ways. It's, you know, it's the interplay. I think we did a couple episodes ago, we talked about estrogen and weight gain. Estrogen in general is sort of a slimming hormone. It kind of doesn't prevent your body from storing fat, but it sort of shuts the signal off, at least enzymatically, where when you're going through this transition, your female hormones are declining inevitably, and then you just have all this cortisol all the time. So automatically, especially women typically do not put weight around the midsection. It is, you know, literally cortisol redistributed body fat deposition. I don't know what the exact term is, but as your cortisol goes up, because you're the next one we're going to talk about, you're not sleeping, you're working full time, you have all these things on your plate.
You're annoyed.
And it doesn't even really matter so much about diet, right? Most of our patients anyways, yeah, they might have, you know, cravings from time to time or this or that, a little bit of a sweet tooth right before their period starts. But most of the time, most women we talk to, their diets are actually pretty good, but they still keep gaining weight.
Yeah, exactly. So with perimenopause, it's more about there's a slight decline in the estrogen, but not, you know, it's not dropping dramatically like it would be in menopause. But in perimenopause, the estrogens, you know, drop slightly, but the progesterone is what plummets. So there's also a little bit of an imbalance between the estrogen and the progesterone. And then you got that cortisol flying around, that it really is almost like a instant recipe for weight gain, which is so not fair, because like you were talking about, these women, they have a pretty good lifestyle and a pretty good diet that they didn't even get to earn that weight.
Yeah, right. They didn't earn it by eating a lot of really yummy food. They earned it just because like there's really no rhyme or reason to it, you know. And that's, you know, even in menopause, same thing. Women are, lifestyles really haven't changed probably in 10 plus years. Their lifestyles are very consistent, and all of a sudden, you know, just like literally overnight, their body is just not cooperating anymore. So that one comes up all the time. And women will use the belly fat term, which I kind of find surprising that they're, you know, they're describing it literally as belly fat. You know, some say spare tires, some say muffin top, some say a few different things, but the majority of them say, I can't get rid of this belly fat. You know, what am I going to do? Especially if they've been accustomed to not having something like that. And all of a sudden now it's like, kind of a stark difference and a little bit, you know, the fear is, I think sometimes, is it going to keep going, right? Is it going to keep, you know, accumulating? It's going to get bigger and bigger. I could see where that would be somewhat terrifying. Most of them are sort of doing, at least in their mind, they think they're doing a lot of things right as far as diet, lifestyle, exercise. They think they're doing a lot of those things the right way, and they can't figure out why it's not working.
Yeah, it's that, you know, that change imbalance between the estrogen and the progesterone, that cortisol is flying around. There's a few other hormones, you know, that interplay, and enzymes that interplay with all of that. But then, you know, you think about females, and hey, I was born in the 70s. My thought was, oh, most women think, oh, I'm gaining weight. What am I going to do? And go eat less. And I'm going to go do a bunch of cardio, yeah. which is another recipe to make that cortisol go even higher.
Yeah. Right. So that's why our kind of mantra when it comes to that, or a motto when it comes to just as a simple thing, is to eat more and exercise less. And the exercise should be more based on building strength and muscle. You and I have been lifting weights together. We're going to actually, when we're done with this podcast, we're going to go and do a workout. We have our little workout set up in the garage. That's sort of exciting. Mm-hmm. We did leg day on Wednesday. What'd you think of leg day?
I thought it was incredibly tough. I was dreading leg day after the first leg day last Wednesday. So it was like, and it's interesting because that's what I was telling you when we did leg day is cardio. I love to do cardio. I want to get on the spin bike. I want to do, I like to go running, but that cardio does make you feel good, but it does make that cortisol go up. So it's not great for weight loss. It's really not that great for muscle building. But when we did the weights, I didn't feel as good afterwards. In fact, I was saying I felt kind of grumpy, or maybe I pushed it too hard. So I can see where a lot of us want to gravitate towards the cardio, because when you're done, you feel good. Where the weights, when you're done, you kind of feel like you're spent. But I know with time, it gets better. You build more muscle, but it really is about building that muscle, not trying to burn the fat off.
Yeah. Well, you're trying to build the muscle to burn the fat off. You're not going to, I guess my caution there,
you're not going to run the fat off.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not going to exercise the weight off. The more exercise you do, in some ways, like you said, you're raising that cortisol. And we've talked about this many different times, but you can't reiterate the point enough, because women need to sort of understand when this shift happens to your body, you have to sort of take a different approach, because the eating less and exercising more will no longer work. And in some ways it just compounds the problem. You get further and further away from your goal, whatever that might be weight wise. And the stomach, because it is cortisol driven, the more you do some of that aggressive cardio and volume over the course of a week, 5-6 days a week or 4 to 6 days a week, you're sending the same message to your body that you're starving to death and running from a tiger. It just gets worse and worse and worse. Now the next one, I would have probably put this one at the top of the list, but just, I don't think it matters. This isn't really a prioritized list. It's just the most common ones. The next one would be sleeping trouble.
Exactly. So sleeping through the night. Most of the time in perimenopause, you have no problem falling asleep, within minutes, within 10 minutes, but it's trying to stay asleep. So with perimenopause, you'll see kind of a combination of either waking up, after right about 3 to 4 hours of sleeping, and then you're up for a couple hours, which is not great. And by the time you're ready to fall back asleep, you got to get up shortly thereafter. That's huge. Or that you'll see women that just wake up all night long. They'll say, I wake up 4 times a night. So then that's not rested sleep. So then, like Dr. Mackey was saying, it's going to mess with your cortisol. You're going to be tired during the day. But staying asleep is a huge one, as opposed to when you're thinking about menopause, they might be waking up at night because they're having hot flashes or night sweats. In perimenopause, you're not waking up because of hot flashes and night sweats. You're just waking up and you can't go back to sleep. Or if you do, like I said, you're waking up, falling asleep, waking up, falling asleep.
Some women, as they're getting maybe towards their later 40s, they can start having the night sweats right before their period.
Yeah, exactly.
That does happen sometimes.
Yeah, maybe 7 to 10 days before the period, even 3 days before, they might get some night sweats. But typically not like in menopause where they might be getting the night sweats every night.
Yeah, I just had a patient actually this week that she's not having anything during the day. It's just really at night. She's just, just really, hot. The covers are coming on and off. Then of course she has to get up for the day. She hasn't slept at all because her sleep is completely disrupted. So that's why I would have put the sleep at the top of the list, because the mood, the belly fat, all that comes off that sleeping tree. Once you get that, and you, even when we see a patient, at least my goal anyways, is there any temperature problems? Yes or no. But is there any sleep trouble? That's the focus for the first month. Because once you do that, then the other things start to kind of take care of themselves. To be honest, when it comes to conventional approaches, they're just not really that many good ones. Sleep medications we wouldn't prescribe anyways. We don't prescribe them because I think that it creates kind of a fake sleep. They're in a class of medications called the hypnotics. And literally it prevents you from getting down to the deep sleep, which is where we get all the rest and recuperation. So you're sleeping, but you're not really sleeping, and then everyone has probably heard of some of the weird things that people do when they take some of those medications. They're buying things online. There's, you know, they're cooking meals in the kitchen. They're doing things they don't even remember doing. Sleeping, I think, is, you know, critically important. And this demographic of women in their 40s to their 50s, even a little beyond, I mean, none of them sleep really all that well. I mean, it's the outlier for women to come in and say, oh, yeah, I sleep great. That doesn't happen very often.
We're all jealous of her.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. That's the very few minority. Majority of them, they really struggle. Or maybe they think they sleep okay, but then you talk to them, they're like, oh, my God, you're going to the bathroom, you know, four times a night or three times a night. That's not good sleep.
Yeah, or waking up. And even, you know, you're talking about those prescription sleeping pills, even the over-the-counter sleeping pills are not good to use. They're only getting you to like a stage two sleep where you're not getting into that deep sleep. They might be bouncing between stage two and REM, but not getting that stage three and four, that real deep sleep. So even that's a little bit of a double-edged sword. And all those medications have a little bit of a dependency to them. So the last thing you want to do is, you know, be hooked on sleeping pills.
Yeah, I know there's some patients use benzodiazepines for sleep. That's pretty popular. Again, very habit forming. I'd be very careful with those. And honestly, most of our patients are not interested in taking them anyways. Yeah. You know, I don't think doctors are really aware. I mean, some of them are obviously, but I think some that prescribe them are not aware of the issues and the potential habituation or dependency on some of those things. I have one patient I know for sure. She's been she was given Klonopin for sleep, and it's just been years that she just can't get off of it. You know, she wishes she, you know, she's told me a few different times that she wishes she never would have taken it because now she can't sleep without it. Literally, she can't sleep without it. You know, she didn't want to take it, but now she's sort of backed herself into a corner unintentionally. Of course, she didn't set out for that to happen. That's what the doctor should know. The doctor should know those things and sort of protect the patient from themselves a little bit, you know, and have that foresight to say, hey, you know what, this is a, you know, highly, you know, addictive substance, and the benzos across the board, are very problematic in that way.
Yeah, no, we don't prescribe those, but we do have a lot of natural alternatives, hormones, or even supplementation, even lifestyle. So there's a lot of things that can be helped with women in perimenopause if they're having trouble, you know, staying asleep.
Yeah, sure. And there's some other, you know, sleep hygiene things, of course, not too much blue light, you know, so screens and TVs, you know, things like that. You want to tone that down. Taking a really nice hot shower or bath before bed changes. So that's where the body's a little different. You take a hot shower, it cools you off. Take a cold shower, it warms you up. So cold showers in the morning or exercise to warm up your core body temperature. Hot shower, or hot bath at night to cool you off. And then, of course, the room should be relatively cool, you know, like we're going into the cold, dark cave kind of a thing. And even in your room, too, if you, you know, have the room as dark as possible, because even a little bit of light can really affect some of that sleep quality.
No, exactly. Not the hygiene, the supplementation, not drinking too much water before bed, which I'm notorious for doing.
I don't know. You go to bed with like two big cups of water and you wonder why you pee all night all the time.
I don't get up that much to go to the bathroom. I used to, but now
the water for then?
If I wake up in the middle of the night or my throat feels dry or first thing in the morning, I like to drink a full glass of water.
I'm just teasing you. I'm just teasing you. I have noticed though, your sleep should be sort of getting worse, it's actually getting better because your sleep has never really been all that great.
No. Even as a kid, I'm notorious for getting up. My parents used to lock my bedroom doors because 3 years old, you don't want a 3 year old running around in the kitchen or in the
that's
living
a little
room.
Questionable though, locking the door. Well, yeah, that's another podcast.
But no, but I do, you know, there's, everybody's different. So that's where, when we're working with a patient, I'll, you know, what works for me might be different than works for, you know, another 49 year old woman. So, so it's kind of finding that recipe.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, like you just said, there's not one thing that works for everyone. I mean, some things there are when it comes to these hormonal issues, but you know, it's very much a kind of trial and error, to find the combination that works. All right. So the next one on the list is low sex drive.
Yep. That low libido. Lots of women in their 40s and at perimenopause, they say, oh, my libido has run out the door.
Yeah. I mean, for some of the same reasons, right? As that cortisol gets overexpressed, and the funny thing is about cortisol, like testing it through blood, it always falls in the normal range. And it's, You know, even doing a saliva test, is some of the saliva tests, you know, they might have the symptoms of having high cortisol, but their saliva tests will say they have none. You know, so some of those things just, it's tough to pull kind of, you know, relevant clinical information from them sometimes, at least through blood anyways. You get a lot more data. I know the Dutch test is really popular. That shows you some of the metabolites and how things are kind of breaking down. That can be very helpful. But usually just, you know, symptoms. They're not sleeping. They're, you know, that there's a cortisol issue going on to some extent.
No, I do. Yeah, for us women, we're definitely complicated when it comes to sex drive. You know, of any age of a female, it's just complicated. Men are a little bit easy in that department, I would say. But as females, definitely with that libido is focusing on those adrenals. That's a big thing, is to focus on those adrenals, like Dr. Mackey was saying about the cortisol. But I do find that for, you know, women in their 40s, there's a couple of different things there. Is when you look at a menopausal female, their estrogen is dropped. And so sometimes they'll have low, you know, their vaginal tissues are dry, pain with intercourse. For a perimenopausal female, they don't have pain with intercourse. It's just like sex is not on the brain. Their partners will complain that they're not initiating anymore. And they're really like, that's like, I'm not even thinking about it. And of course, when you're tired, the last thing you want to do is more, you know, extracurricular activities in the evening. But definitely it's not on the brain. But I will ask women, are you initiating? Do you have sex on the brain? But once things get rocking and rolling, are they okay? And they'll usually say, yeah, I'm not even thinking about it. I'm not initiating. But, you know, once, you know, things are going, it's actually pretty good. So you do see that a lot. And then, like I was going to mention too, when you're in perimenopause, you're not necessarily ovulating as frequently as you were when you were younger. So that change in hormones from not, you know, because with ovulation, estrogen's, you know, skyrocketing right before ovulation, progesterone is starting to come up and peaks at day 21. So this kind of change in cycle, that tends to also blunt the libido.
Yeah, right. And then, of course, in menopause, when those hormones are literally kind of flatlined, that's why what we've seen a lot over the years is that a lot of practitioners, doctors will just give women a bunch of testosterone to raise their libido. And to be honest, it doesn't really work all that well, you know, because for a woman, a testosterone is not really a reproductive hormone. It can be, as long as they have a good foundation of estrogen and progesterone, that peak, you know, right where they ovulate, the body, a woman's body does create a peak of testosterone right around ovulation, which should or encourage an increase in libido. So then conception, you know, a woman getting pregnant would be more likely to happen. So there is a little surge in libido right around ovulation, but the other hormonal peaks have to be in place in order for that to happen. So if there's a inevitable decline to the hormones, then all those peaks don't match up, and things just sort of, like you said, they're just not on the mind anymore.
Exactly. It's just more, what do we call it? Like a symphony of hormones rather than just one main instrument.
Yeah. Now for men, pretty easy. You raise their testosterone, or you decrease the belly, the beer belly, or both. And usually their libido is relatively fine. You know, but it doesn't, you know, it's not quite as simple. You can't just give women a bunch of testosterone, and expect her libido. Now for some women, they have, what I would call a little bit more of a higher androgen tolerance. You know, granted, they're probably used to having a higher libido anyways. So for them, testosterone could be okay. But the majority of women have a relatively lower androgen tolerance. They can't tolerate a whole bunch. They start breaking out. They start growing hair on their chin. You know, all the cosmetic things that women don't want to be dealing with.
Yeah, so it's really more complicated. But at the same time, though, once you kind of get somebody sleeping, their energy is better, their mood is better. You get some of those hormones balanced. You know, through lifestyle, supplementation, maybe even a little hormone modulation there. That libido does come back, because women will tell me, it's, you know, hey, I love my husband, I'm attracted to my husband, but I just don't have sex in my brain. So it's really just kind of finding that balance.
Yeah. And the libido coming back, if it's been gone for a little while, the fact that the libido sort of does eventually come back is a really good sign of balance. That means that all those other parameters are kind of in a good place. And then it just kind of magically reappears. It may not be like it was when, you know, when we're 25, you know, or 18 or whatever. But at least it's still, you know, it's still there. Another one, again, not necessarily prioritizing the list, which one's the most important or the most common. They're all common. Yeah. And in some ways, every one of these will be just one woman, and she has all those complaints. So last one on the list, again, for some women, this would be number one, but period changes.
Yeah, this is the time, you know, in the 40s and perimenopause when hysterectomies, if that's going to be happening, having that uterus removed is this time. Having an ablation where they ablate the lining of the uterus going down to the basement membrane, so they're not removing the uterus, women will tell me it was the best thing they ever did because like I was mentioning, that progesterone plummets, but the estrogen doesn't really drop too much. So you've got a lot of estrogen, which estrogen loves to thicken up the lining of the uterus. So that's where you see heavy periods, painful periods, long periods, two periods in a month.
Yeah. Maybe there's, they've never had blood clots before and now they're having blood clots all the time. You know, that sort of is uncomfortable, inconvenient, you know, heavy. They become anemic if it's too heavy. Right. And it's happening, you know, maybe in their later 40s when they think they should be, it should be dwindling away, and then disappear. It actually gets heavier before it finishes. And now granted, I will say that it's sort of a normal process. I don't think a lot of people realize that that's, it doesn't mean there's any problems. It's not you have any issue going on. It's just the way the brain and the ovaries are sort of communicating and how those hormones are responding as a result of that.
Yeah. And that's the time when fibroids that might have been more dormant start to kind of cause more issues. Women can start to, you know, grow uterine polyps, which are completely benign, but it's, you know, more that, you know, that growth inside the uterus, but it's not that it's dangerous per se. Sure. You don't want to have low iron or be anemic from bleeding too much. But that, like I said, that's the most common time for a woman to have a hysterectomy because you don't want to put a woman in their 40s on birth control. So, you know, a lot of gynecologists...
Even though that happens all the time.
I know. Yeah, it does. But you really don't want to do that. There is some IUD options, but it doesn't always guarantee that they're going to have, you know, lighter periods. And then one thing that, you know, with women will say is their periods are not as regular. So, you know, I've had stories of, you know, the heavy day ended up on a vacation and they were on a plane. What do? You know, I'm at a reunion. I got the heavy day, or it started, you know, out of sync. So at least when people, if we can work on those periods during this time to make them more regular, women will know, okay, my period's coming on this day. I'll have a little bit more awareness. So I'm not, you know, out of the blue shocked with a heavy period and I don't have anything to help me. And then also at the same time is balancing those hormones so that that lining of the uterus doesn't get so thick. So you can minimize that bleeding.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That comes up, you know, quite often, or it just starts to become either if there's no heaviness, then it just becomes more sporadic. You know, they skip 2-3 months at a time, or maybe it gets shorter. You know, some women say they get a period every 21 days. Some it's maybe every 35 days. It's just kind of random sometimes and how it usually you would expect if it's shorter, under 28 days, it's going to be a little lighter. If it's over 28 days, it's going to be a little heavier because there's more time for that tissue to grow if it's longer than 28 days. So, you know, just a lot of things going on there that, again, the conventional options, birth control and IUD, you know, we don't like either of those options. There's usually much better solutions for those two solutions.
And like I was saying, it's not that this is a bad thing. This is nature's way of, and everybody's different. I do think there's a little genetics that play into it. If someone's going to have more fibroids or heavier bleeding, or someone breezes through perimenopause to menopause, everybody's a little bit different. I would say on some of those, you know, an ablation probably would be okay, but you still got, you know, it's still a procedure, you know. Granted, you don't want to jump into surgery and you don't want to jump into taking birth control pills or, you know, synthetic hormones to do this. So, you know, that's why I think a lot of women, they feel like their hands are tied, but there are, you know, there are some good options.
Yeah. Yeah, there certainly is. So that's the, you know, that's the list. Is there any kind of extraneous ones that you might, you know, if we expanded it to the top 10, what else would you throw on the list that we didn't mention?
A lot of women will in their 40s with that perimenopause, because so that estrogen drops. The estrogen drops a little bit. The progesterone really drops. The testosterone's still around. It hasn't dropped too much. You got all these adrenal hormones like the cortisol that, so this whole mix can create you can actually have like hair loss, acne. While women in their 40s say, I haven't broken out since high school. And I'll tell them probably because when you're just starting to get your period, you know, puberty is the hormonal balance is very similar to that of a woman in perimenopause. You know, when a girl starting to get her period, she's 13, the not really ovulating as often, so there's not a lot of progesterone, the estrogen is surging, there's more estrone in a younger female, which causes more of the issues with weight gain. But you'll see acne because the testosterone's coming up, so it's almost like these women in their 40s have these teenage girls and then they really end up butting heads.
Yeah, but they're hormonally, they're in a very similar situation, you know, which is sort of ironic.
Hair, skin, even nails will change. People say skin integrity changes, hair texture. Women will say, I never had curly hair, but now I've got frizzy hair. Something about those hormones, they change the texture of the hair a little bit too.
Yeah. So, and then full blown hair loss like alopecia, but then an increase in shedding for a lot of them. Shedding certainly freaks them out, right? You know, all of a sudden now in the bathroom, the shower, the sink, the brush, you got this hair everywhere. Your hair is everywhere.
Well, I have long hair.
Yep. Your hair is everywhere.
So one piece of my hair is equal to like 5 pieces or 6 pieces of your hair.
Well, my hair is growing longer now.
It's looking great. You're growing it out.
Yeah. It's always been short. Now, you know, a little experiment time. I
got now it's like a SoCal surfer.
not quite, but yeah, I don't even know where I heard this from. I think it was one of the lectures that we continuing education course. The average human loses 100 hairs a day, right? So shedding in general is sort of normal. But we have, you know, talked to lots of women over the years, and when their stress is high, the shedding increases. Okay, so all those things we said before, excessive exercise, not sleeping, all those things can exacerbate the shedding, which isn't exactly alopecia, right? Because there's no deficits. The hairline is fine. The crown of the head is okay. The temples are fine. But yet there's just this hair everywhere. That's sort of normal to a certain extent. You know, that we want to just try to tone down the shedding so it's more in a normal range. But women will say all the time, like they can tell that the volume of their hair is less because the thickness of their ponytail is less than it was just a short while ago. Sometimes within 6 months, their ponytail will be half the volume that it was. Now, I don't really know what that means exactly because I've never had hair long enough to put it in a ponytail, but I'm sure you can relate to that. Like you have a certain thickness that if your hair still always looks great. You haven't had any, even though your hair is everywhere, you haven't lost any of it. But your ponytail, like, do you pay attention to things like that yourself?
No, I do. I think a lot of women do. And there are ways to balance to help with the hair because it is terrifying for women. And some women that is their main concern is the hair loss because they're afraid, hey, I've lost this much hair thus far. Is it going to be gone? Like, is it all going to be gone in a year or two? So it can be very scary, but you're right. Yeah. They do kind of go by the ponytail. I go more about, you know, like you said, the shedding, are you missing it more from the top or the temples? Like, is it more, which would be more androgen derived or is it all over? And then of course, other than the perimenopausal hormones, checking the thyroid and a few other hormones there. But yeah, I'd say hair changes are a big one.
When we first moved to Bellingham, you had a hairdresser here in town and I told you, you got to go somewhere else. And then your sister came along and told you the same thing. And then you did it. Well, I've been telling you for months, you got to go somewhere else. Cause I know what your hair is supposed to look like. And she was not doing a good job.
She really wanted to, cause my hair is thick. She really wanted to like do this texturizing thing to thin it. And I'm like, no, because hey, I'm in my 40s. My hair isn't straight anymore. It's like a little frizz to it that I don't need layers with layers with frizzy hair. It just makes it more frizzy. But I liked her and I really wanted to give her, you know, everybody starts somewhere. She was new, you know, everybody starts somewhere.
Well, she can experiment on other people's hair, not yours. the hairdresser you had in Vegas, we lived there, she was fantastic. She was fantastic. Your hair always looked fabulous. And you had a couple, we lived on Orcas Island for a couple of years, and you had like two different ones there, I think,
or just one.
And she was good. She was good. I didn't notice really any major difference, but then you got one when we first moved to Bellingham, like, nuh-uh, that ain't cutting it. No way.
Well, I will say all us women in our 40s have our hair person that we go to. They're our expert. They give us the information. So if you're not sure if you're losing hair or not, because everybody has normal shedding, seasons can change the shedding. People shed a lot in fall, a little bit, more in spring. So ask your hair person, does it look like I'm losing hair or any baby hairs coming in? Because they can give you a lot of insight and then
We've gotten a lot of referrals from hairdressers because they'll touch, it's amazing. Like they have this memory to each client's hair when they're touching them with their fingers that, you know, I don't even know what you call it, that, you know, acuity with their, you know, that's probably not even a word, you know, just touching it, they can feel some of those changes, even though they might not have seen them. Now, how often, this is me being a dumb man, how often does a woman go to the hairdresser?
Well, everyone's different, but if you're
on average
hair colored, so if you're just getting it, you know, when I was in my 20s, you know, I would go 6 months before I would go. But now, because maybe I might want to get, you know, my roots touched up, is I like to go every like 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks. I'd say some women go a little less than that if they really want to touch up the hair and, you know, if they're
meaning a brunette, trying to get rid of the gray.
Yeah, get rid of the silver.
The silver. Mm-hmm. But and now isn't it popular now to have the silver streak?
Oh,
isn't
my
that
gosh.
Kind of a thing? Or is that just a very temporary fad?
No, a lot of women grow out their silver hair and it's gorgeous. I mean, some people actually, like younger women, will pay to have their hair colored to look like that. So really?
Is that a thing or you just make that
no,
up?
No, it's true. I mean, I think there's, you know, I have patients, they've grown out their hair and it's beautiful. And I think there's even like Instagram, I don't know what you even call them, things that people like go and, you know, look at people's hair, or they post up pictures of their hair after it's grown out. I do think COVID, a lot of people grew out their hair because we couldn't go get it colored, but everybody's different. You know, I'm 49 going on 50 this year, but I don't have a lot of gray. I'm only about maybe 25-30%, which is kind of like that.
No, more like 2%.
You're so nice, but I'm in that weird
25-30%. You have a couple of strands here or there.
No, you.
Yeah, you're talking like three hairs, no. And you're called that 30%.
I don't know what you. Yeah, because that's why I go every 6 weeks. You can't tell. But
is that really the case? If you didn't go for like a couple of months,
I'll show you right before I'm going to go see Angie. I'll show you the little spots. I have it in kind of a different area, like you know, I can cover it up a bit, but I'm in that weird thing where if I did let it grow out, it might look a little weird, where I have other women, they grow out their gray hair because they're maybe more like 80-90% and it's just beautiful.
Well, I think you're you always over-exaggerate. Yeah, I don't think you have 20-30% gray hair.
I think I do.
I don't think so. Yeah. But anyways, I am paying attention. You don't think okay. I am, but I am paying attention.
Well, you have no gray hair and you're 48. Well,
I'm blonde. I'm not going to have gray hair for a long time.
Well, that is really nice when you're blonde. It just kind of blends right in. That's us brunettes are a little jealous of that.
Yeah, whatever. So the hair issue, big deal, comes up all the time, right? Because this perimenopausal window is when all those hair changes happen. So certainly that could have been, for some women, that might be at the top of the list, right? So acne, skin issues, hair, can you think of anything else?
A lot of times, because it has to do more with the adrenals, with pregnenolone. Pregnenolone drops because of this. When cortisol goes up, pregnenolone goes down. But pregnenolone is a hormone that helps us with learning. So what you see in perimenopausal women, when that pregnenolone drops, it's hard to understand, harder to learn. Where in menopause, you have the information in your brain. It's just hard to get out. So menopause, because estrogen drops, the recall, like, oh, I can't remember that name of that movie. Ask me in 5 minutes and it'll happen. Where in perimenopause, it's like, what did you just say? I forgot what you said. Let me write it down. You know, you've got your notes, you got your post-its. So it's more about trying to get the information in your brain in perimenopause, where in menopause, it's trying to get the information out.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to describe it. Or, you know, like for work or something, they have to read reports. Sometimes they say they have to reread the report a bunch of times because they can't really comprehend it.
That memorization.
Yeah. Any other extraneous ones? I think we ran through a pretty good list there. I can't really think of any off the top of my head.
No, I think we covered a lot, and I'm sure there's probably more I'll think of that'll come to my brain, perimenopausal brain later.
You're having a hard time pulling it out of there. Well,
that'll be my menopause brain, but I'm almost there.
Yeah, right. I think this is a pretty good exhaustive list. Hopefully, if you're dealing with some of those things, we've given you some insights. We didn't really talk too much about how to deal with all those problems. Maybe we'll do that on a follow-up episode, still, nonetheless. Any last final comments? Are we good?
Nope, this was good.
Okay, until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.